Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Hopes and Dreams, brought to you today by The Blindium Project. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, The Blindium Project is a collection of dreamers, healers, visionaries, and thought leaders. We aim to inspire the global majority through creative storytelling and placemaking to live unapologetically and authentically. Hopes and Dreams is our long-form conversational series with the aim to showcase, strengthen, and liberate. And today's story is sponsored by us. That's right, you heard it right. Today's show is sponsored by us because we believe in the power of these stories and they need to spread their wings. However, if you or one of your clients is interested in learning more about our growing socially conscious, environmentally friendly community at the intersection of Black and Brown culture, you can reach us at blindianproject2020@gmail.com. In today's episode, we sit down with Saket Soni, author and founder of Resilience Force. In 2006, following Hurricane Katrina, Saket Soni uncovered one of the largest cases of forced labor in modern U.S. history, involving several hundred Indian men promised careers and green cards. The Great Escape, a true story of forced labor and immigrant dreams in America, compassionately captures the story of these men and their quest for freedom. And without further ado, let's get into it. Hello, Saket.
Hey, Jonah, how you doing?
I'm very good. And you?
I'm really glad to be here. Yeah, I'm doing well. It's a rainy day in D.C., but great to be with you here.
Yes, thank you for joining us. Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to write this book, The Great Escape. When I got the message to actually enter conversation with you and the team, I had never heard about The Great Escape. I had never heard about this story. I had never heard about this happening. So I found it as a person who seeks knowledge and information. I just thank you for actually bringing these people's stories to light and doing the work that you do.
That's very kind. Thanks, Jonah. And thanks for reading.
Okay. Right. So everybody's wondering who doesn't know who you are. Tell us a bit about yourself, Saket. And I've heard other interviews before, and you usually start from the Chicago part. I want to know Saket before that part, when you're growing up, your youth and your background.
My youth and background. Well, yes. My long ago youth was spent partly in New Delhi. I was born in India, in New Delhi, and partly in a lot of other countries. My father worked for the Foreign Service. He was posted to consulates around the world. So I spent part of my childhood in India, and then every few years would go out to other countries and then return to India. So I led a pretty nomadic childhood. And as a result, I got to I got good at moving between worlds, you know, from India to Singapore and then back to India and then out to Pakistan and Jamaica. And then when I was 17, I moved to a whole new world. I came to the United States. I'm probably the, I came to the United States to study theater. And I think my parents are probably the only parents in the 5,000 year history of India to let their son go to the United States to study theater. That's what I was doing in Chicago. I went to the University of Chicago on a scholarship, was running around doing theater, directing plays, trying to be a playwright.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I love that you said that because I didn't have to actually come in and say that. Like, how I'm thinking that as well too as I'm reading the book. How on earth did he get to go to university and do theater? How did you convince you? It sounds like you didn't have to convince your parents.
I did have to convince them. I mean, they were quite distraught when I announced my plans. I grew up. My parents are incredibly loving and they've always been incredibly supportive of everything I've done. And growing up, one of the ways that my dad and I bonded was over books. He used to have this old crockery cabinet that he had kind of turned into a very deep bookshelf. And it was really dusty, and all the books were from his college days. And we'd sit there at the beginning of my summer vacations, and he'd fish books out, you know, and I'd read those books, and we'd bond. And so that got me really into reading and writing and literature. And so one day I announced that I was going to study English literature with, you know, and they said, what on earth are you thinking? Like, how are you going to make that a life? How are you going to pay the rent? How are you going to make that lucrative? And I said, well, my plan is to make that lucrative by, you know, focusing on theater. I'm going to direct plays. And so they were quite distraught. They wanted me to do anything else, you know, do theater over the weekends. But I think when I got the scholarship to the United States, they thought, okay, this might work. Like, maybe he can get, you know, a teaching job at a college or something. I think that calmed them down a little bit.
Yeah. And how did all of that, you talked about your kind of upbringing being quite nomadic. And for me, I take from that automatically, you're coming in and out of cultures. You're in a culture that's, you know, normal to you, and then going to a slightly different one and kind of learning how to mold yourself and flex yourself to be able to exist in these different worlds. How did your upbringing kind of bring you to the work that you do today?
Well, I think what I learned was that, you know, sometimes you get to a place and you're the stranger and you wonder if you'll ever fit in and you wonder if you'll make friends. It's scary being the stranger, you know, except when you step back and you realize that we're all strangers in some way or the other, you know, and those two people who have a deep, long relationship, you know, well, they might have one day been strangers to each other, you know? So moving to new places every 2 or 3 years, setting down new roots, having to make new friends. I think I learned that people are actually a lot more welcoming than we give them credit for. And all you have to do sometimes is step in and start the conversation and try, you know, it doesn't have to be as hard for strangers as we think it does. People are, you know, people tend to like new friends, even if they won't admit it to you. And that's sort of been a practice of mine. I think that a lot of what I do now is helping strangers not feel like strangers, you know, helping immigrant workers not feel like strangers, building bonds between people who were born outside the United States and just moved here with people who have never left the United States, finding a basis for those friendships and bonds. You know, that's really what you're doing as an organizer. I mean, it sounds fancy. You're a labor organizer and you're fighting the system and trying to raise wages. But at the core of it, there's just human beings who have to find connection, and having built connection, you know, use that connection powerfully to change the world. It all has a basis in friendship. And I got to kind of moving around and being a stranger so much got me to enjoy, you know, moving between worlds and realizing that friendships can be built wherever you go.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And just tell you a quick story. I studied abroad, and that studying abroad in Dublin made me want to travel in Western Europe. So I backpacked in Western Europe. I saved up for a year, traveled for 3 months, and traveling alone was a great experience because you meet as many people almost as that you want to meet, that you extend yourself to, that you see at the bar or in the restaurant and decide to speak to. If you want to be by yourself, you very well can be by yourself. But if you want to meet people and have a great time, you need to extend yourself to that contact with people. So
true. Yeah, that's so true. It's a good metaphor. I think of my childhood as one big backpack trip.
Yeah.
It resonates. Yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned labor organizer. There's also human rights strategist. Now, a lot of people, when they see that word organizer, we know what it is to organize our cabinet or our fridge. How do you describe being an organizer? How do you describe it to a little kid or a young kid if you had to?
Well, organizing is, it's just the process of getting together with people, with other people, because something you want is important enough, big enough, that you can't get it yourself. You know, you want to buy something from the grocery store, you can go yourself, right? You can drive out, you know, to get where you want, most days, right? But the way that people have changed their conditions, whether it's, you know, women who until recently couldn't vote, you know, in many countries and fought for the right to vote, or whether it's, you know, workers on a factory floor wanting a better wage, you know, or abolitionists in the United States or elsewhere, Britain and elsewhere, wanting to bring an end to the system of enslavement, systems of enslavement. I mean, these large scale changes are just not, they're not possible, you know, as a result of individuals. We can't do that ourselves. First thing, you know, and there's a lot of people right now, you look at these big problems, climate change and inflation and you know, abuse of immigrants, you know, anti-blackness in the world. These are huge systemic problems. And a lot of times, you know, people get demoralized and they think, you know, what can I do as an individual? What can I do alone? There's nothing I can do alone. Well, the answer to that is you can do something as an individual, which is you stop being an individual, stop being alone, go join up with three or four other people, and then join a bigger group and a bigger group until you're part of a force, you know, that's trying to change something, trying to change your school district, trying to change your neighborhood, or trying to change the country by protesting or voting. Mm. All of those processes of joining up with other people is called organizing. The way I ask you a question to find out, you know, what you care about and whether it's the same thing that I care about, and can we walk together? Can we fight together to change it? That's organizing. It's done, you know, it's done in many ways. It's been done throughout time. And it's simple and it works, but it just takes time.
Sure. Thank you for that. What type of situations do you find yourself in on a daily basis then as an organizer?
What kinds of situations? Well, you know, organizing is about solving problems. So you know, as a labor organizer, you're trying to solve the problems of workers. I work with a lot of immigrant workers who rebuild homes and schools and cities after hurricanes, floods, and fires. And so every day I, you know, am trying to solve the problems of those workers, getting them paid if they're not paid, you know, getting them care if they're injured. In fact, my book, The Great Escape, starts with a scene of me trying to solve a very particular kind of problem, a really thorny problem. It starts with a scene on my birthday in New Orleans, where I'm sitting in an unheated car with my coworker, and I'm trying to help a Honduran day laborer ransom his kidnapped nephew. This is a worker who approached me. He said, "My nephew's been kidnapped by coyotes. Can you help me? We got together with him. We tried to solve that problem." And the book opens with this scene late at night on an unlit street in New Orleans, a street that's still torn up after the hurricane of the previous year, and we're trying to get his get his nephew back. That's an example of a very extreme kind of problem that I would try to solve.
Sure, sure. Now you've mentioned, so let's talk a bit about the book, right? So in the book, it gets to a part that's revolving around a situation that has come as a result of Hurricane Katrina. So I'm conscious of the fact I'm based outside of London, you're in DC. There are gonna be people who are watching this stream from different parts of the world. Could you set the scene for what that was like in New Orleans and that part of the world in general?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Hurricane Katrina was a pretty world-changing event for people living in the United States. It was, the year was 2005. And although there had been, you know, hurricanes before that, this was an extraordinary one. There was in August 2005, a very large hurricane that made landfall in Mississippi, about 4 or 5 hours away from New Orleans. And that would have been destruction enough. But then what happened was that the levees, these walls that surround New Orleans and are supposed to, you know, protect New Orleans, levees similar to the ones you have in Europe, you know, in Scandinavian countries that protect those countries from water, you know, from flooding. The levees in New Orleans, surrounding New Orleans, broke. And as a result, the city was flooded. And this flooding, you know, was followed by a catastrophic negligence by the federal government. So what you had was around the country, you know, we were watching, I was sitting in Chicago and watching people on rooftops, you know, crawling from their attics. You know, the floodwater would rise up to the attics, and then people would crawl from the attics to the rooftops, and they were waiting to be rescued by a U.S. government that didn't come. Now, most of those dead, displaced, and most of those waiting to be rescued were African American. Flooding, you know, obviously the hurricane is a natural event, but Katrina really unmasked how those kinds of catastrophes have a real racial impact, that the people who were predetermined to be the worst affected, to be killed, displaced, lose their home, lose their land, lose their income as a result of the hurricane were largely African-American, and largely in New Orleans were the people who were also at the center of the economy, the culture, the food, the music, yes. You know, everybody who drove, everybody who made New Orleans, right, was all of a sudden up on their rooftops waiting to be rescued by a government that many said seemingly didn't care. And that launched, you know, an extraordinary social movement in the United States. People were outraged. And, you know, a lot of people, a lot of people, this was the Bush era. This was George W. Bush was president. And it was really, you know, this was part of the social movement that really grew from there and wound up, you know, with the election of President Barack Obama. So it was one of those really altering, you know, history-making events in the country. And I wound up, like many people, you know, I wound up watching TV in Chicago. I was a young community organizer. And the thing is that in Chicago, which is far away from New Orleans, you know, New Orleans is down in the South, Chicago's in the Midwest, very far away, a place I'd never been. But I wound up connecting to it because my job as an organizer was to knock on doors in poor neighborhoods in Chicago, to help renters get a better deal with their rent. You know, I was organizing renters. And a lot of those people were older African-Americans who had their roots in the South. A lot of people had migrated from the South.
To the Great Migration.
And the way they were watching the events of post-Katrina New Orleans, you know, they weren't surprised. There was a large-scale surprise. I mean, the liberal media and others were saying, how could this happen in America? And instead, these older Black folks were saying, who I was watching TV with, would say, of course this is going to happen in America. What else is going to happen? They were accessing a deeper history. And so I just thought I had to go. I went to New Orleans to volunteer initially as a relief worker, but I ended up staying 16 years and moving my life there to be part of how the city and the region got rebuilt.
Sure. And so in the book, then, we learn about how this catastrophic event then creates this economy almost for essentially, I don't want to say cheap labor, but let's just say for lower cost labor than they would normally be bringing in. And out of the blue, one day you receive a call from a gentleman, and I'm sure you receive a lot of calls like this from people that you don't know. But this gentleman has an Indian accent. I just want to know what was going through your head when you received that call that day.
Yeah, the story starts with this mysterious midnight phone call that I got. And what was strange about it was exactly what you said. This is a man not only with an Indian accent, but speaking to me in Hindi, relieved that he had someone to talk to. He had obviously just arrived all the way from India, just arrived into the part of Mississippi that was devastated by Hurricane Katrina. I was used to getting calls from workers. People would call who were mostly US-born, Black or white, or if they weren't, immigrant workers would call who were Latin American workers, you know, from Honduras and Mexico and many, many other countries, Mexico, South and Central America. And they were either living in the U.S., they'd come in from Houston to help rebuild. The post-Katrina flooding had turned the Gulf Coast into the world's largest construction site. And all of this rebuilding was being done by immigrant workers. But this was a man from India, and I wondered how on earth did a man newly arrived from India find himself in the Mississippi Gulf Coast? It turned out he was one of 500 Indian men who were brought from India to rebuild oil rigs in the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Recruiters for a big oil rig company, a big shipyard, had gone to India. They had recruited these men, promised them green cards and good jobs if they would come to work for this company. The picture you see is a kind of aerial view, helicopter's eye view picture of this huge, sprawling, half a football stadium size dock that they had. It was a maze of interconnected factories and metal workshops where, these men arrived to build large oil rigs for this company. Now, recruiters made them incredible promises. They promised them the American dream, the chance to get a green card, which is what you need to move permanently to the United States. You know, they offered these men the chance to come and live in the United States and be joined by their families in 9 months. And the catch was that the men would have to pay enormous sums of money for the opportunity. They paid $20,000 a piece. This was, the equivalent of $500,000 for them, more money than they than they had, more money than anybody had in their family. So they sold ancestral land. They sold their wives' jewelry. They sold their own homes. They put homes on the hawk. They took high interest loans from moneylenders. And they came and they found themselves in an American nightmare. It turned out that all the promises were false. There were no green cards. The men found themselves on temporary visas, living in a labor camp, 24 people to a room, working round the clock shifts behind a barbed wire fence. And to live in these conditions that you see, they were charged $1,000 a month in rent. That's where they found themselves.
Which was a slap in the face. I think, so things that I find really interesting from that is that I would have still been in the States. You know, there's no thought or concept, I think. I mean, obviously I was in the Midwest, but you know, there's no thought or concept that, hey, this has happened. Do I know who is actually doing the work to fix this and try to rebuild the city? You know, there's no thought or I think even visibility from where I was sat at to know these were the types of people who were being brought over to help rebuild the country. One thing I have to say about this, the book and the way that it starts is, you know, you see the title, you see what it's about, but I love the way that you humanized these men's stories. And you wouldn't even know that it was about them being trafficked over to the country. You could think you're wrapped up in a love story, mm-hmm. you know, in a South Asian or Indian love story, and someone's being pressured to get married, and no, he doesn't want to take the shoddy on, and all of this other stuff, and he likes somebody else, and it's a love marriage, you know, how dare great. He? And so I just love the fact that you humanize them, and that's how the book almost opens up, hearing and reading these different stories about the struggles that these people went through to effectively raise this money.
Yeah, I'm so glad. I'm so glad you said that. You know, I wanted to write this as part, you know, political conspiracy thriller, part love story, because that's what, you know, that's what
I can tell.
So that was a choice. I mean, it also helps that these men who are at the center of the book are just such beautiful characters. Yeah. And they were, you know, 20 something at the start of this book. So what do you care about when you're 20 something? You know, there's a character named Ebi Raju, who's right at the heart of the book. He's you know, one of the protagonists. And before he's trafficked to the United States, his biggest problem is his mom is trying to get him married. Yeah. You know, and he doesn't want to be married. He wants to date. He wants to be a 20-year-old. You know, he wants to have a life. And he wants to go back to being a migrant worker. He's been away from India for 5 years. He worked in Bahrain. He came back and he saw the things that his parents would never tell him on the phone. He saw that his father couldn't afford to retire. You know, he saw that in the Indian economy of the time, his family was sinking and he needed to get back out there, make more money as a migrant worker and help his family. Meanwhile, his mother has put an ad in the paper about him in the matrimonial section of the paper. Yeah. She's trying to get him married, you know, and he's like, well, I don't want to get married and we can't afford a wedding. But then something happens. You know, he accidentally winds up on the phone with the woman his mother has chosen as his bride to be, the bride to be in his mother's dream arranged marriage for her son. He winds up on the phone with her and when he hears her voice, he falls in love with her. Mm. Now he has a new problem. By then, he's taken the loan. He's sold the house. He's bought the American recruiter's story, and he's ready to go to America. Now he has to tell his bride-to-be that he's going to leave for America 2 days after the wedding. So now he has a big new problem. And so, you know, this woman who's now his wife, Binsey is Ebi's wife, you know, they go to the airport. Ebi leaves for America. Binsey believes that she's going to join him in 9 months. Not only that, but by this point, Binsey's pregnant with his child. Well, you know, it turns out the promises were false, and Binsey doesn't end up seeing him again for another 3 years. Ebi will not meet the son that was born to them until that child is 3 years old. And that's that story of love and separation is really, those are the stories at the heart of the book. I mean, every immigration story is a love story, you know, by definition, by necessity. And I tried to approach these immigrant stories as love stories.
Thank you for that. So one thing I'm thinking about, and we've even seen it recently when the recent World Cup, and I think this is another thing that a lot of people don't think about, is the amount of, let's say, South Asian or Indian people who end up doing work, similar work like this, in places like the Middle East, right? So we saw this in the World Cup, and this happened, obviously, Hurricane Katrina. What do you think this has to say in general for these kind of capitalistic societies that we live within?
Well, you know, India has over a billion people, right? South Asia is an extraordinary subcontinent. Young people like Ebi, you know, who, Ebi was 25 at the time that he saw the American ad in the paper, you know, and wanted to go to America. I mean, these are people who cannot make ends meet in India. They can't fulfill their dreams in India. There's not enough money. Prices are too high. You know, jobs pay too little. And families need food on the table. So what workers like Ebi decide to do is to become migrant workers, to leave the families they love in order to provide for them. That's what it is to be a migrant worker. Mm. You know, you, as Ebi once put it to me, you leave the ones you love to help them live, you know, you leave your family behind, and you just want to get to a, you know, a recruiter or somebody who's going to throw you like a dart at the global economy, you know, and you hope you reach a country where you can wire money home and help your family live. That's the pursuit of the migrant worker. Now, you know, given that, companies around the world for many, many decades, you know, industries around the world, the oil industry, you know, the shipbuilding industry, you know, industries around the world have taken advantage of this, and they've used South Asia as a place to get cheap labor, as a place to draw in labor. You know, the way Dubai turned from a desert to a city was through South Asian labor. It was South Asian migrant workers, not only from India, it was also Sri Lankans and Bangladeshis, you know, many others who came and built. So we're not just talking about a little bit of, you know, building a house, right? We're talking about building extraordinary oil refineries or you know, oil rigs in the ocean that look like palaces, in the water, like enormous, you know, city-like structures. And then recently you have the same thing with the World Cup, right? All these stadiums built again by South Asian migrant workers. And, you know, I think what it speaks to is the need for, you know, if work needs to be done, then workers need to be welcome and they need to be safe and paid well. They need to be able to return to their families. You know, people are not against doing the work, but on what terms is the question for all of us, you know, and what kind of moral human society extracts work in a way that leaves workers who are already migrants, which is bad enough, you know, falling to their deaths instead of keeping them safe and well paid and thanked, you know, after the work is done.
Sure, sure. And right, so later on in the book, we come into this point where we learn about your own struggle. Sorry, not this part here, but we come to this part later on in the book where you come into your own struggle of, you know, not being legally documented within the country. Again, I thank you for sharing your story as well too, because oftentimes we're led to believe that people who are undocumented, they look a certain way or they come from a certain place. And just hearing a bit about your story was just a different perspective that I think was great to input to this kind of wider conversation that hopefully this will start.
Yeah, you know, there was a picture you had up of me in a jacket and tie.
Yes.
That was the 26 or 27 year old version of myself, you know.
Yes.
And I think that jacket was probably either borrowed or stolen. You know, the tie was deep inside a duffel bag I had from my theater days. You know,
You had somebody else tie it for you, right?
I to this day don't know how to tie a tie, but you know, I had to win the trust of these workers, and so so you know the book was interesting to write. I wasn't initially going to be a character in the book. Then I realized that I had to help readers navigate these worlds, you know, worlds that I knew that you maybe don't know, right? Mm. A Mississippi labor camp, right? The Mississippi labor camp that the workers were trapped in, or New Orleans after Katrina. These were worlds I knew. I lived and breathed in these worlds. And in a book, you need a guide, you know, to walk you through. You need a tour guide. So I had to be that. But then there was a new problem. If I was going to be in the book, I had to be an interesting character, you know. Not only that, but I was sharing these deep personal stories of the workers, you know, their love stories, their complexity. I was sharing about their difficulties in their marriages, you know. Their love stories. I was sharing how they were on their bad days, you know, because that's what makes characters interesting. We don't want to read about, you know, saints versus sinners or perfect immigrants, you know, because those don't exist. We want to read about complex human beings, you know, with emotional conflicts and difficulties, people who are trying to be better, but aren't always their best selves, right? And so I realized that I had to sort of treat my own character that way. So I don't know about you, Jonah, but I think you and I are now the most perfect, fully self-actualized versions of ourselves, right? But it wasn't the case when we were in our 20s. When I was 28 at the beginning of this book, I did not have my life, my act together. My life was a mess. You know, I was living in New Orleans, running this small little nonprofit, you know, I was estranged from home. I was carrying a lot of guilt for not sending money home. I wasn't calling my mother. You know, she would call me, and I would send her to voicemail. I wouldn't call her back for months. You know,
I think we've all done that.
a lot of conflicted feelings and immigrant guilt and difficulty. And at the center of it, you know, I suddenly had this new thing, which is that these 500 men from India were in the middle of my life. The last people I was basically an American in all but passport. And, you know, and I was so estranged from India that the last people I expected to drop into the middle of my life were 500 men from India. And they were. And suddenly I needed them to trust me. So, you know, they were happy, you know, they wanted a U.S. attorney carrying a briefcase and a jacket, you know. I didn't have a jacket that fit me, you know, I didn't know how to tie a tie. I was trying to get them to trust me, so I couldn't actually admit my vulnerabilities at the time. But they were there, and in the middle of it was my own immigration status, which was vulnerable. I had been undocumented, When I was in Chicago, running around doing theater, I had missed an immigration deadline, and I slipped out of status. I didn't think it was that serious, but then 9/11 happened, which really changed the lives of lots of immigrants in the United States. That tragedy became the pretext for a lot of anti-immigrant policy and practice. You know, I was suddenly being attacked in trains and in elevators, in buildings. You know, I lost my normalcy and my foothold in normal American life. And I was just sort of dealing with all of that, my immigration story and the love story, my own love story that's kind of at the center of it. I don't, no spoilers, but that's at the center of the book. And I just decided that as an author, I had to tell that story, both to make an interesting character out of myself, but also to kind of fulfill a moral kind of, you know, kind of obligation to these other men, because I was putting their hearts like right out there. I was putting their stories right out there. And, sure. And I had to add mine as well.
Sure. No, but thank you for that. I mean, even you just saying, I mean, obviously you would have came over on some type of student visa, something like that, and then it expired, right? I think that people often, you know, undocumented means that you swam through a river and then crossed over a border somewhere. People have that thought in their head. And, you know, I think that it's important that we know that they're all different types of people doing different types of things that for some reason or another, you know, sometimes fall into this status of being undocumented.
That's a really good point. You know, in fact, South Asians are a large share of the undocumented people in the United States. Indians are among the fastest growing undocumented population in the United States. And among South Asians, just like among Latin Americans, there are lots of mixed families, you know, an undocumented child, a documented child driving his dad to work who's undocumented. And so the dad can't have a driver's license, right? Or a documented daughter, trying to access the healthcare system, navigate, the American system for her undocumented parents. All of this exists in the South Asian community in the U.S. And it's really important, like you're saying, it's important to tell these stories, stories that we're sometimes too ashamed to tell. But it's important to tell these stories about the community.
Sure, sure. So as we're getting to the end here, so one thing that I found really interesting, the people who initially kind of put me in contact with your story and with the book, I think they knew that I'd like it for a certain reason. But, you know, at the Blendium Project, one thing that we strive for and work towards is, you know, I call it kind of Black and Brown solidarity, which can mean a lot of different things depending on where you're at in the world. Black and South Asian solidarity, we can call it that as well, too. You know, there was, as we move on through the book, I can see you really trying to make a connection. And you mentioned a person by the name of Ted Quant. A friend and a mentor, but somebody who was very pivotal, even though he doesn't show up often in the book, to get the workers on site. Talk a bit about Ted and your relationship.
Well, Ted was a mentor of mine when I got to New Orleans. You know, he took me under his wing. He had been an African-American labor organizer and teacher to many, mentor to many. And he really taught me, along with many other people, he really taught me what it means to be an organizer in the American South, and particularly how to bring African-American organizing history to bear. So when the men engineered their escape from the labor camp, Ted became a mentor to all of them. And what he and other Black organizers taught the men, you know, these were people who had newly arrived from India, they had more faith in the American system than most people born in the United States.
Sure.
They thought, well, all we have to go do is get to Washington, D.C., and we'll just get what we deserve from the government, you know? It took Ted and others to complicate that and explain to the men that, you know, people, many, many people in history have fought to get what they deserve in America, you know, people of color, Black people, and other people in the United States. And this is really a longer fight and a harder fight than you think. And it became the basis not only of learning, but of deep friendships, just like I had with Ted, deep friendships between the men in the book from India and their African-American neighbors, the people who they were in the midst of, friendships that still remain and that are treasured. And I think that's really the basis of change, is building bonds with people who don't look like you. And particularly if you're fighting for justice, building bonds with communities who have been at it much longer than you have, so you can learn from them.
And was it difficult for, so this is my perspective from somebody who's traveled to India several times. Was it difficult to try to make the connection between the Indian men who had probably never interacted or engaged with African American or people of African descent before, to then now be trusting these people that you're bringing to them and trying to share their stories?
You know, it took a lot of discussion and education. I think that there are many parallels in India that I was able to draw from. You know, many of these men were from lower castes in India and had histories of in their own hometowns, you know, where it took relationships to make change, right? At the end of the day, though, I think that, you know, these men that were trapped in a labor camp and they engineered an escape. And when they were out, they knew they needed help. What I did intentionally was put them in relationship with the kind of help they didn't know they needed. You know, they didn't know that they needed to the help of people who had, you know, been on strike before. And you know, I put them in relationship with organizers who were part of the, you know, the Memphis sanitation workers strike, you know, which made change for workers. So those signs, "I am a man" and "dignity" came from those, you know, pictures of those strikes. I think that it takes friendships to change your mind. And the first thing I set out to do was build real friendships between these Indian men once they were out of the labor camp and African-American organizers. And those friendships, I think, changed their mind.
Mm. Thank you for that. And as we get to the end here, what was it about the Southern labor organizing that you thought was important? You also make reference to having them understand that was part of their journey to, I guess, kind of believing that they could escape and be free as well too. But what was it about the Southern labor organizing that you wanted to draw from?
Well, you know, these men were not the first who found themselves in a labor camp by the Mississippi River. You know, they were not the first to be trapped and not allowed to escape in a camp on company property in the American South. You know, the idea of bringing over cheap or free labor and then controlling that labor, not allowing it to run away, and in fact running after it to catch people if they run away, all of which happened to these workers. Well, that idea is about as old as America. You know, it's American slavery. It's the indentured servitude system that came afterwards. It's what happened during Jim Crow and after. And you know, I needed these men to understand the history they were stepping into. If they wanted to change it and have a different outcome for themselves. I think that was at the heart of it.
Thank you for that. Okay. We're at the end. We're almost at the end here, but while I was reading this book, I was like, this has to be a movie. This has to turn into a movie. So who plays you in the movie?
That's a very funny question. You're kind for asking. I haven't given that much thought, but I'll tell you one thing. All the Indian men who are at the heart of the book, the Ebi Raju, the newlywed, guy and the Hemant, the young lover in New Delhi who wants a love marriage and is, you know, trying to pursue his girlfriend's dad to get him to agree with it. All of these characters made up their minds long ago about who would play them in the movie. And I think that they all have, their own great ideas, their own cast. They're really thrilled. They asked me the same question. And actually, we, I don't know if you've seen this Indian, this like, blockbuster Indian movie called RRR.
I haven't seen that yet, no. But I've heard, my mother-in-law, but my wife's actually Telugu. So they won't let me not hear about that.
I can't believe you haven't watched it in that case. Well, there's Telugu speaking workers who are part of this campaign and who are in the book who see themselves as the heart of the movie version, even if they were on the minor characters in the book. And they've picked those two actors to play them. You know, one of those two actors that played. That we're at the heart of RRR.
Gotcha. Okay. Look, the way that we always close this Hopes and Dreams is asking people such as yourself or the people we're interviewing, what are your hopes and dreams for the future? So I would like to pose that question to you as we close out here.
Well, my hope for the future, my dream for the future is that we live in a world where migrants are welcome and strangers are celebrated. You know, we're all going to become migrants at some point. You know, we move from place to place. Our lives are made of arrivals and departures. And I hope for a world where all the courage it takes to move, all the courage it takes to be a migrant or an immigrant is celebrated. I also hope for a world that, as a result, the kinds of bonds that you're trying to build between different communities, are stronger. And part of the majority culture, not something we have to bring into the mainstream, but there is really a deep part of how we live our lives in the mainstream.
Thank you for that. Let me just try to give anybody here in the audience an opportunity to ask anything or pose anything. I think we have a question that was, what was something interesting that you have learned or gathered from this conversation? If everybody would like to insert that into the chat, would love to learn or would love to know about one thing that you learned from this conversation today. And thank you for joining us wherever you've joined throughout the world. Do we have any takers here? I don't think we do. But Saket, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jonah. Thanks
I
for having me on.
I want to applaud you and celebrate you. And thank you for bringing these people's stories to the world, bringing this topic to the world, and just all of the great things that you're doing to try to make the world a better place. So thank you for being another spoke in the wheel, shall they say, to try to make this place a better place for us all.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.